From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, best-selling novelist Mary Gordon. Her new book is a memoir about her father. He died when she was 7. She's always said that's the most important thing you could know about her. But her sense of her own identity changed when she uncovered the lies her father had built his identity on. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel she describes as brilliant, Mason's Retreat by Christopher Tillman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Authorities in northern Bangladesh say more than 400 people died in a pair of tornadoes today. Thousands of others are believed trapped or injured. The BBC's Richard Galpin reports from Dhaka.
The worst damage was in Tangail, where officials say thousands of houses were flattened in a matter of minutes by winds of around 150 kilometers per hour. According to eyewitness accounts, three villages have been totally destroyed, with bodies still trapped inside the buildings. The rescue operation is now in full swing, with the army assisting the local police force and government officers. The Red Cross and Red Crescent have also sent medical teams to the area, as well as emergency supplies of medicine, food, and clothes. Violent storms are quite common at this time of year, with local depressions hitting the region in the run-up to the monsoon, which normally breaks in June.
Richard Galpin reporting. Federal investigators are still looking for the cockpit voice recorder and more victims' remains in the Everglades ValueJet crash. Last night, a diver stumbled across the flight data recorder. A spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board says there's no information yet from the initial study of it. He also says authorities are looking at evidence that there could have been problems with the DC-9's electrical system. Meanwhile, recovery of the victims continues. Officials are meeting today to decide on a strategy to better comb the swampy crash site. A charter airline based in Georgia that also operates planes for Senator Bob Dole's campaign trips has been grounded. The Federal Aviation Administration issued an emergency order grounding AV Atlantic because its flight attendants may not be properly trained. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The FAA issued an emergency suspension order effective immediately, grounding AV Atlantic's 7 Boeing 727 jets for charter and lease, including one used by the Dole campaign. The airline will remain grounded until it complies with the FAA's requirements for flight attendant training. The order indicates that an FAA inspector found discrepancies in the airline's flight training records and told the company not to use any unqualified flight attendants. But inspector found that a flight attendant on Sunday on AV Atlantic in Atlanta had no current manual, no cockpit key, and was unable to describe pre-flight inspection. The attendant also couldn't describe how to use the emergency oxygen equipment or locate or describe how to use the plane's fire extinguisher, first aid kit, emergency medical kit, or the life rafts. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The White House says trade talks between the United States and China have stalled. The likelihood of American trade sanctions against China is growing. The dispute centers on Chinese firms that the United States alleges have been pirating U.S. property. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 32 points at 5,613. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. A major power outage has hit half of Delaware and most of the Maryland Eastern Shore. The outage began almost 2 hours ago, and the cause is not known. Kevin Mearshart of member station WSCL in Salisbury, Maryland, reports.
Police have asked the residents to stay off the roads as streets all over Delaware and the Eastern Shore of Maryland have become jammed due to traffic lights being out. Switchboards have also been jammed with calls from concerned customers served by local electric companies throughout the area. Delmarva Power and Light serves most of the area. Officials there say that at 10 a.m. this morning, a piece of equipment at the Keeney substation near Glasgow, Delaware, failed. That caused a loss of power for virtually the entire power grid south of the C&D Canal, which covers more than 200,000 customers. Schools and businesses have closed for the day. Officials say it will take between 6 to 8 hours to repair the equipment and restore the power. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Mershard in Salisbury, Maryland.
Final arguments from defense lawyers come today in the Whitewater-related trial in Arkansas. Some former business partners of President Clinton's, James and Susan McDougal, and Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker are being tried on fraud charges. Mr. Clinton gave videotaped testimony in the case. Prosecutors came close to attacking his credibility yesterday but didn't. Observers say that may happen today during their rebuttal. The current trial revolves around loans allegedly obtained by Tucker and the McDougals in the failed Whitewater land development. A government witness says then-Governor Clinton benefited from the deal. Mr. Clinton denies this. The government says consumer prices jumped 0.4% last month, triggered by a huge increase in gas costs. The Commerce Department points out that the core rate of inflation, which doesn't take volatile food and energy costs into effect, rose only 0.1%. The government already says wholesale core inflation rate for April was up sharply. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mary Gordon, is the author of several best-selling novels about the conflicts facing contemporary women, and she's written many essays relating to her life as a Catholic in conflict with the Church. In her new memoir, she writes that at the age of 44, she discovered she wasn't the person she thought she was. Let me explain. The memoir is her exploration of her father's life, and doing the research into his past, she learned that he wasn't exactly who he said he was. And when she learned that, she had to alter her sense of who she is. This passage is from the beginning of her memoir, The Shadow Man, A Daughter's Search for Her Father.
My father died when I was 7 years old. I've always thought that was the most important thing anyone could know about me. I've told his story hundreds of times because I thought his life was extraordinarily interesting, extraordinarily complex. And in telling his story, I took on the luster of having an interesting and complex father. No one could know me very well without knowing some of the high points of his history, his riotous youth at Harvard, then in Paris and Oxford in the 20s, his career as the king of Cleveland soft porn, the editor of a humor magazine called Hot Dog, his conversion in the 30s from Judaism to Catholicism, his turn at that time to the political right, his becoming a Francoist, a Coghlanite. This isn't the first book I've written about my father. When I was 10, and he'd been dead only 3 years, I attempted his biography. It began, "My father is the greatest man I have ever known." For many years, I believed it. Well into my adulthood, he was the untouched figure of romance. He was so much more compelling than other people's fathers. He was a writer and a convert. While he was still alive, I'd watch him walking to the station on his way to work in the city, wearing a hat and hard brown shoes, holding a thin leather briefcase. Unlike other children's fathers who wore caps and carried lunch pails, on his way home from the train station, he would fill his pockets with candy and walk down the street giving sweets to all the children on the block. "Thanks, Mr. Gordon," they would say, the children who didn't speak to me and to whom I had no wish to speak. No wish and no need. Why should I talk to children? I had him. But the whole enterprise was a charade, a costume drama. He wasn't going to work. His work was a series of schemes to get rich men to bankroll him and his magazines. Occasionally he was successful, but not for long, never long enough for him to support us. It was my mother's money that bought the candy for the children. He was the Pied Piper on her salary. And his gifts didn't make the children stop taunting me with the information their parents had given them. "We know your father doesn't have a job."
It's Mary Gordon reading from her new memoir, The Shadow Man. Mary, why did you want to investigate your father's life now? Why now?
That's the most obvious question to ask and the most impossible one for me to answer. The whole project started out of writing itself. I was writing something that I thought was about my grandmother's house. I had an image of my grandmother's house, which I followed and wrote about. And I realized in writing that I was really writing about my father's death, because we had moved there after my father died. And then I kept writing about the moment of my father's death and how that was such an enormous break for me. And I suddenly had a great number of pages. And it occurred to me in a terrible way that I didn't know this man that was the most important man in the world to me, this man that I thought I knew so well, I really didn't know at all, and that there were ways that I could know him better. So in a way that's very mysterious for me, I said to myself, it's time now. It's time to do this.
You know, you said in the passage that you read, you said that your father's death was the most important thing anyone could know about you. Why was that so important in your definition of yourself?
I think that that moment of loss was really a defining moment for who I was, that a person who had lost at a very early age was the person whom I shaped myself around. And it was the moment that all my work came out of, in a way, the recognition of loss, bearing witness to loss. It also gave me a real differentness from everyone around me. I was marked by loss at a very early age, and the loss of the person who was most beloved and most important to me was also the end of joy for me in my childhood. And I had to rediscover joy in adulthood.
And it was the end of joy not only because your father died, but because you moved into your grandmother's house where things were much more somber.
Well, they were much more harsh. They were somber and unplayful, and I was constantly under surveillance and constantly judged as wanting. Whereas in my father's eyes, nothing I did was less than spectacular, less than glorious. So it was a tremendous shift of focus.
And at your grandmother's house, there was constant disability. Your mother had had polio. Your aunt had had polio. Your grandmother was around 78. You say,
yes.
You were always the most capable person.
Yes, I say that one of the other important things about me is I always feel like the most able-bodied person in any room I'm in. I mean, I could be, you know, in a room with Arnold Schwarzenegger and I'd still feel more somehow. I'll lift that for you, Arnold. Don't worry. You know, don't tax yourself. I can do it. I think it's a feeling that a lot of women have of being more capable or more able to do things than other people. But with me, it was very literally inscribed at an early age.
I think one of the things that must have made your father so interesting to you is that he seemed to have such an interesting life. He edited a humor magazine. He was involved with softcore. I mean, these are not things that typical fathers did.
No, particularly not typical working class fathers. And class is a very important element in my history, as I think it's a very important and well-kept secret in American life, because my mother was very working class, and her mother and that family that I moved into. And my father really presented me with a world that included the larger world. One of the things that differentiates the middle from the working class is how much of the larger world do you feel you have access to? And my father suggested to me that I had access to the whole world, and because he had done so much, or he had told me he'd done so much. He actually did both more and less than he told me. But he did always give me a sense that other people's fathers were going to work and being responsible and respectable, and he was being adventurous and romantic, and it was very exciting.
What did you know about his humor magazine, Hot Dog, before you started researching your father's life? And what did you find out when you actually found Hot Dog in an archive?
Well, when I was 12 years old, I was going through some of my father's books, which were mostly very high-minded, very religious books. And I opened up one of these religious tomes, and I saw something called Hot Dog. And I had known in some odd way that my father had edited a magazine called Hot Dog. And I opened it up. I was 12. I was the most law-abiding, puritanical 12-year-old. My entire life was based on Audrey Hepburn and The Nun Story. That was my ideal for myself, just perfection and exclusion and absolute obedience to the rules. And I opened this magazine and saw a bare-breasted woman saying, "Lover, come back." And I had to say, my God, this is my father's magazine. So as a law-abiding and Antigone-like 12-year-old, I took the magazine, I ripped it into shreds, and I flushed it down the toilet. And I said, nobody will ever know about this again. Well, I did look I used all the, you know, computer-based searches and everything. And I found copies of Hot Dog in the New York Public Library in Brown and later tracked it down to some collectors. Of course, looking at it as a woman in her late 40s, in the late 20th century, it's nothing. But it's corny, and that actually became more embarrassing to me than the fact that it had a bare-breasted woman, you know, which would embarrass me at age 12. But it was so corny, and it was so provincial and so of its time. At the same time, he was always trying to be serious. So there were these, you know, one-liners like, you know, some guys get married, others get by. And on the next page, there'd be an article about Flaubert. And it was that same tremendous incoherence that marked everything about my father. And I was saying, what did these guys think that were buying this magazine for pictures of chorus girls? And all of a sudden, they're reading about the temptation of St. Anthony. And it was wonderful in that way of my father always trying to put things together that couldn't possibly be put together.
Well, had you thought when you were young that he was like a wonderful writer and that you could never live up to how good he was?
Oh, exactly. I thought he was just elegant and intellectual. And the single hardest thing in this project for me, and some of my beloved friends really had to endure a lot of abuse from me, was I would show, you know, the first time that I wrote a draft of the chapter about what my father did, there were pages and pages of his prose. And finally, a friend of mine said, you know, Mary, we're interested in your writing, not in his. You're a much better writer than he was. I said, oh, you know, something unprintable. How stupid you are. And finally, a woman in my agent's office said, this has to be radically cut. Nobody can read him. He's not interesting. That was the single most disturbing thing for me, having to understand that he really wasn't that good a writer, that there was a lot of incoherence, a lot of bombast, a lot of undigested or half-digested ideas, and that I was, in fact, the writer that he wasn't. That was terrible.
Why was it so crushing to find out that he wasn't the great writer you had imagined?
I think that he made a place for me in the world of letters. And if I had knocked him out of the place that he made, then it's the, I guess, I don't know how this works psychoanalytically, but it is an Oedipal moment, I guess, even for a daughter, when you have, you know, in a way killed the father who gave you life. If I had to say, I'm better than he is, that was almost a way of killing him or stealing something from him. And I felt that he was so vulnerable in his death, and I had stolen something from a beloved dead man. I had stolen the primacy of place in the world of letters that he had created for us.
Must have been useful, though, to have thought of him so highly, because that gave you, that helped you make a place in the world of arts and letters. I mean, you know, you kind of inherited a place there if you thought he was so good.
Yeah, and I know that, believe me, I do know that my father was quite mad and in ways that were not always benign, although the malignity didn't touch me directly. But what is really a great gift that my father gave me that a lot of women don't have was that he said, this world that I inhabit is yours. And there is nothing that you can't do because you're a woman. You are my heir. And he gave me a tremendous self-confidence in the world of language and thought from the moment of my being a tiny child. He gave it to me. He brought me into it. He said, it's ours and it's yours. And so there were a lot of things that I didn't have to unlearn that some girls
mm-hmm,
did.
Mm-hmm. Mary Gordon is my guest, and her new book is a memoir about her father called The Shadow Man. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with novelist, short story writer, and essayist Mary Gordon. Her new book is a memoir. It's about her father, and it's called The Shadow Man. Your father lied about several pretty important things. He'd been married once before marrying your mother, and he never let on about that. He lied that he was an only child. He wasn't an only child. And he lied, he said he was born in Ohio. He was really an immigrant. What purpose do you think these lies served in his life?
I think that being who he was a torment for him. And I think he lied as an anesthetic. I think it relieved the torment. He had to make himself a person he could bear to be. I think he couldn't stand being an immigrant. He couldn't stand being a Jew. He couldn't stand being uneducated. Why he lied about being married before, I think he just, after a while, wiped out the past. And also, after his conversion, it would have created problems of canon law for him if he wanted to marry my mother. So I think that he really found his life unbearable and his position in the world unbearable, and he had to create a new life that he could bear.
Your father was Jewish but converted to Catholicism in the 1930s. Do you think that was part of that changing of himself so he could find himself and life more bearable?
I think so. I think that one of the sad things is that I came up against so many dead ends and so many blank walls. My father would be 102 if he were alive now, so practically everybody that was connected with him was dead. I can only imagine that his family life or his life in the community was anguishing to him, and I think that being a Jew in the early part of the century, it's remarkable when I started to research it, how anti-Semitism was just in the drinking water. You couldn't get away from it. And I think that was unbearable for him. And he wanted a place in the great cultural life of Europe that was not a marginal place. I think he saw the life of the mind, the life of art, as his way out of the tumult of this immigrant hubbub that he couldn't bear.
Did you know when you were young that he had converted to Catholicism from Judaism?
Yeah. One thing about my father was he never tried to pass. And he used his status as a convert. I mean, you kind of have to understand the culture of the Catholic Church from about 1930 to 1960. To be a Jewish convert was a real mark of distinction. And in a way, my father picked the perfect place where he could leave his Judaism but not have to hide it. So that as a Catholic convert, you could say, okay, I've left that. I'm not a Jew anymore, but I was a Jew. I don't have to pretend I'm not. And as a matter of fact, it is a badge of my superiority that I have left error and found my way to truth. So he didn't have a lot of the anxieties of a name change or you know, the terror that somebody would find out he was Jewish. He never did that. What he did was actually a little bit more complicated and a little bit more sinister, because he said, I'm a Jew. I know what they're like. And they're really dangerous. And I can tell you the insider story.
Well, some of his writing was really quite anti-Semitic. And he supported the fascists in World War II.
Yeah. He did. He was very strongly a Francoist. He was an isolationist into 1943, which is really late. He was kind of denying that Hitler was very bad. You know, he said, well, he's bad, but there are a lot worse. And as a matter of fact, the English and their persecution of the Catholic Church in Ireland were just as bad as Hitler. He was pretty pro-Mussolini. Where this came from, I cannot imagine, except a kind of phobic determination to embrace the other.
Did you pick up on this hate when you were young, or did you just find this anti-Semitism as an adult, researching your father?
I found it as an adult, and it was crushing for me. It was morally annihilating for me, almost, because I had really loved him and still do, and have to endure the truth that he was really saying hateful, wicked, things. And I had had his magazines. And the way that we erase things that are unbearable to us, I think, is always very interesting. I must have known since at least my early 20s that he had written this anti-Semitic stuff, but I just didn't take it in until I sat down really to read him almost as an author who was not my father. And so it was only a few years ago when I had to look at this stuff and then research more of it that I had to confront the horror of his hatred and self-hatred. And the virulence and the nastiness of what he said. And it was excruciating for me.
So what are you rewriting about yourself, knowing more about who your father really was? What changes about who you are?
I feel like I am a less fathered girl now. And more of a woman who doesn't define herself so much by him. That I'm more alone, and now the next however many years of my life are a task in which he has less and less of a place. Mm-hmm. And in a way that's very sad, but it's a little bit exhilarating.
Why is it a little bit exhilarating?
Because I'm grown up.
I'm not, right.
I'm not primarily a daughter anymore. I don't define myself as being his in that way. And to say I'm not, the most important thing about me is no longer my being a daughter, it does make your lungs expand a little bit, mm-hmm. however painfully.
Mary Gordon's memoir is called The Shadow Man, A Daughter's Search for Her Father. She'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with writer Mary Gordon as she wrote her memoir about her father, which forced her to revise some of her most cherished memories of the past. Her elderly mother was losing her memory. Also, Maureen Corrigan recommends Christopher Tillman's first novel, Mason's Retreat.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with writer Mary Gordon. Her new book is a memoir about her father called The Shadow Man. Part of the book is, of course, based on her own memories of her father and her childhood. Many of those memories turned out to be distortions.
You say that you not only lost your concept of your father while writing this book, but you lost your faith in memory. And I would like to hear read my favorite sentence from your new memoir. You write, "I entered the cave of memory, which nowadays seems like a tourist trap in high season." And you go on to say, everyone's talking about memory. French intellectuals, historians of the Holocaust, victims of child abuse, alleged abusers. What do you mean when you say that the cave of memory nowadays seems like a tourist trap in high season?
Well, kind of what I said, there's a new industry in recovering memory, and partly it's very important and partly it's very vulgarized. I think that we believe in memory in a very unsophisticated way. So, for example, the topic that's so much on everybody's mind, abuse. You know, suddenly everybody you know had an abuse story, and the question is, were they really abused or were they not? And this is what's anguishing, I think, about memory, is in questions of justice, it's enormously important to try to figure out what really happened. But the more you try to unravel the past, the more the mix of fact and narrative overlay becomes inextricable. And people go back to the past, as we said, trying to find the golden ancestor, trying to find the criminal. And then people want, as in the case of the Holocaust, I think, to erase the past and say it didn't happen at all. The trouble with memory is how complicated it is. And to really confront that is a project that very few people, you know, who happen to be on Geraldo on Thursday morning, for example, are willing to do.
How reliable did you find your memories were?
Oh, terrible. It was really shocking. Also, for a novelist or for a writer, you believe in memory as, you know, the gilt-edged stock that you can constantly get dividends from. And, you know, then you find out you bought a swamp in Central Florida. All these things that I would have sworn happened, I couldn't really pin down. And a lot of the times I went back and found that, you know, they couldn't have happened and that I made them up. And they were so real to me. I couldn't tell you the smells and the tastes, and some of them may not have happened at all.
Give me an example of one of those.
Well, I had a memory of being with my father on a merry-go-round in a subway terminal. And I can tell you what the hot dog stand was like. I can tell you what the signs were like. I can tell you what it smelled like. And I know that there could not have been a merry-go-round in a subway terminal. Who would put a merry-go-round in a subway terminal? But for me, I have a very clear memory of being with my father in that place, which could not possibly have existed. I have memories of conversations with him, which, as I try to imagine saying the things that I believe he said to a seven-year-old, they're incomprehensible. He could not possibly have said them. There were just images that were so strong that I believed happened that didn't really happen.
As you were writing your memoir about your father and sifting through your own memories and trying to find out things that you never knew at all, your mother was losing her memory. She was in her 80s as you were writing this. And, I mean, she was losing so much of her memory, she was already forgetting that she had been married to your father.
Yeah, she didn't. She doesn't recognize his face in pictures. She asks who she was married to. What's interesting about my mother's loss of memory is that she remembers only her mother and me. And so I was desperately trying to find this person, my father. And she had lost her husband, the image of him, the memory of him, the sound of his voice, with absolutely no pain and no regret. And so I was even more alone in my memories of him.
What did it make you think about in terms of ultimate value of memory, watching your mother so completely lose hers, and really not, your mother wasn't even able to recognize what it was she'd lost.
It just made the whole issue of memory more and more vexed, because I could see that without memory, my mother had become less alive, not really herself anymore. And so that thing that we call a self, I understood, is so constituted by memory. And yet there she was. You would have to say she's the same Anna Gordon. She's alive. She's clearly human. She is capable of response. And so simultaneously, she was herself and absolutely not herself. And I had to understand both those things at once, the absolute essentialness of memory to the definition of a self, and the fact that one could still exist as a human without it.
You say, watching your mother, that you realized, you know, one of the advantages for her of not having memory was that she had no dread, because she'd always forget what it was that she was facing. She didn't have to relive the terror of a painful medical test. But then you say, but how is pleasure judged if it can't be relived? I thought that was an interesting observation.
It became very, very practical issue, because she's in a wheelchair and she's, you know, immobile. It's difficult to get her from place to place. So I would always say, oh, you know, do I take her down to the garden? Do I take her to my son's play? Because I would go through these incredible physical machinations to arrange something pleasant for her. And literally 20 minutes later, she wouldn't remember it. And she would enjoy it at the moment. But then the next time I had to, you know, say, am I going to get an ambulance for her? Am I going to push her down this hill? I would question, you know, what's it worth if she doesn't remember it? And you have to really shift your focus in a radical way and say, it is only the present, and the present is worth something. But since we're all kind of capitalists of our own expenditure, I think, it makes it very vexed. How much do I do? How hard do I work? How much do I try to make a good time for her? And I used to desperately try to make a good time for her. And I've let up on it a little bit, because since she doesn't remember it, it is worth only what it is worth at the present. And it's very strange to have to make those calculations.
Another paradox that you faced while writing this book, you say there wasn't a day when you didn't wish your father was alive, but at the same time you were beginning to think if your mother might not be better off if she died.
Yeah, it's my mother is somebody I have a heartbreaking love and tenderness for. One of the things that hurts me very much is when people read what I wrote about my mother and say how cruel I am and how angry I am at her and how much I must hate her. I don't hate her. I love her very deeply, and she breaks my heart. And her fate breaks my heart. She really sits and stares most of the day. And, you know, the question is this being alive? Would she be better dead? She's not in pain, she's not suffering, but she's not really alive. And so I sometimes think, well, you know, it's time for her to go now. You know, she's lived enough. This is not really a life. It's time for her to go. Although I'm sure when she does die, I'll feel enormous grief. But my father is still, for me, a relatively young, vital man, because he exists in my life. So I can fantasize about his coming back. And, you know, I'll walk outside the studio and there he'll be, and we'll go off and have lunch together, and it will be heaven.
My guest is Mary Gordon. Her new memoir about her father is called The Shadow Man. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mary Gordon is my guest, and her new book is a memoir called The Shadow Man, A Daughter's Search for Her Father. You know, your father is so full of surprises still for you. You're still, like, learning things about him because he died when you were seven and he lied so much about his life. Is your mother an already really well-told tale? I mean, do you think that there are really secrets in her life and things that you'll eventually find out about that will shock you?
I think there are secrets, but I'll never find them out. No, nothing would shock me because I think I wish I had been able to know more of her inner life. She's a heroic woman. She was a polio victim, and she worked all her life till she was 75. But she was a woman of great imagination and dreams, which in that working class way had to be repressed to get on with life. And I wish I had more access to her dreams, and I never will. So in terms of a biography, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to find out that she had, you know, a hot love affair with a sailor. But I wish I had known what her desires and her dreams were. Those might surprise me, but I never will know them.
Well, there's something in your book that reminds me of what you're saying also. When she was in the nursing home, there was a questionnaire that was supposed to be administered, and you decided to ask her the questions yourself. And the questions all had to do with the quality of life and whether she was happy or not. And she responded positively to all the questions as if she was perfectly content and happy and comfortable. And then you said what to her?
I said, do you really mean that? Are you really happy? Or are you just afraid of making a fuss? Do you think that that's unseemly to complain? And she said, oh, yes. You know, I don't want to seem to be a whiner. And it was another heartbreaking moment for me. So finally, I mean, talk about, you know, the questionnaire comes out the way you want it. Did I want to hear that she was unhappy? Did I redo the questionnaire? But finally I said, you know, and she said a person who respected people's work so much, because she importantly defined herself as a worker. I said, Mom, it's these people's job to get the right information from you. And if you don't answer the questionnaire, honestly, they're not going to be able to do their job well. And she said, oh, okay. And then she talked about her own grief and her own despair. But it was so important to her to be a person that didn't complain, that kept going, that did endure. And it was only when she saw that she could be helping somebody else's work that she felt the responsibility to be honest.
And confess to how miserable her quality of life was.
Yeah, yeah, and how much she had lost.
But, you know, I was wondering if you thought that a lot of her inner life was that way when she was younger, that she wouldn't confess to anybody what she was really thinking or feeling because it would be perceived as she was whining.
Yeah, I think that is the immigrant story in some way. You just keep going. You just, you know, you just do it. And it's something that I admire very much in a particular way, but it's at an enormous price. It's really, you know, what is not said really just gets buried and does some terrible things to people. I do think, though, that my mother had a very deep spiritual and religious life, so that even when she's saying, you know, I'm pretty miserable now, she believes that it's God's will and she's going to get her reward in heaven. So the despair is not thoroughgoing for her, because I think she enters into a very deep religious place even now when there's not much else left of her consciousness.
With that memory, does she remember much about her religion?
Yep. What's the other thing that's so amazing is what is left of her memory. She remembers every prayer that she ever said. She remembers every saint. And she remembers the word to every song written between 1910 and 1950. So she doesn't know what her husband's name is, but if you ask her to sing, you know, Peg of My Heart, she's got every verse and all the mysteries of the rosary. So prayers and song have really remained for her. It's very strange.
You know, I think for a lot of people, there's always a couple of voices in your head that are kind of directing you or helping you make decisions or whatever. And I think, you know, a lot of us internalize our parents' voices. But sometimes you realize, or you get old enough to realize, that those two voices are actually in conflict, that your mother and father would have seen this this thing quite differently. And so you have these two competing voices in your head arguing about what the correct moral or ethical or practical stance is on something. Do you know what I mean? And I wonder if you have that in your mind.
Well, I think it is always the practical as opposed to the impractical. You know, that my father's voice tells me, just follow your vision. Go as deeply as you possibly can. Give yourself over to it utterly. And my mother says, you know, what about your place in the world? That is not to say fame or success, because both of them were very highly ethical people, and that they didn't care about money or success at all. They cared about virtue in some way. But my mother is always saying to me, you know, get on with it. Don't dawdle. Don't dream. Get on with your business in the world. You have a relationship to other people. Whereas my father's voice says, just give yourself to the vision wherever it takes you. And that's a real conflict, whether I want to be a practical person in the world or a visionary.
Well, yeah. And in fact, you know, you wrote a piece recently about the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis auction. And in that op-ed piece, you referred to your mother. And you say that she was always saying, it doesn't pay, you know, well, about a lot of things. She said, it just doesn't pay. And that you say she created a world, like an interior world where, okay, loss was kept at a minimum, but pleasure was always suspect and beauty was thought a waste of time. Yeah. And I thought how interesting it must have been for you to be brought up in a home where beauty is a waste of time, and then you become a writer, an artist.
One of the stories about my mother when she still had her memory, and she always had a great sense of humor that I think underscores this, was, you know, I had written, I think, 4 or 5 books at the time, and I was looking at a Bergdorf Goodman catalog, looking at things which I could never have dreamed of buying, you know, these white silk suits and things like that. I was saying, oh, God, I'd love to have that. Oh, isn't that beautiful? That is so beautiful. And my mother looked at me and said, when exactly did you become such a superficial person? And
and so beauty was just a sign of your shallow, you know, being interested in beauty. Yeah.
And so if you take that to questions of style, as I try to write beautifully, there's always something in me that's saying, well, you know, why are you doing this with your life when, you know, there are children in East Harlem that can't read and there are babies in Africa that, you know, have no food, and you are devoting yourself to beauty, and for what? It is a very great conflict with me.
How do you resolve it?
I just know I'm not good at anything else, so that that makes it a lot easier.
Well, Mary Gordon, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Mary Gordon's new memoir about her father is called The Shadow Man. Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan recommends a new novel. This is Fresh Air. Strictly speaking, it's a fashion faux pas to wear white before Memorial Day. It may also be a critical faux pas to announce one's pick for must-read literary novel of the summer before then. But a book critic, Maureen Carrigan, has thrown caution to the wind and nominated Christopher Tillman's first novel, Mason's Retreat. Here's a review.
I guess it's inevitable that when faced with a brilliant first novel, we reviewers will flatteringly compare it to the work of other, more established writers. But the advance blurbs on the book jacket of Christopher Tillman's first novel, Mason's Retreat, are so hyper-fulsome, they make Tillman sound like some kind of Frankenstein's monster stitched together from the body parts of great American male writers. He's a little of, quote, John Cheever, William Maxwell, Wright Morris, William Styron, Eugene O'Neill, William Faulkner, and F. Scott Fitzgerald. To add to the confusion, I have one more name for the donor list, Henry James. All the while I was reading Mason's Retreat, I felt the clammy aura of the turn of the screw in the room. Not that Tillman's novel is, strictly speaking, a ghost story, but a Jamesian atmosphere is created here by the setting, a great Victorian wreck of a house, combined with the presence of a creepy wise child who baffles the surrounding adults. And like James, Tillman treats his readers to the exquisite discomfort of watching a tragedy we can't quite characterize slowly unfold in suspended time. Mason's Retreat opens in 1936 on the ocean liner Normandy that's carrying Edward Mason, his wife Edith, and their two sons, Sebastian and Simon, back to the U.S. For the past decade or so, Edward and his family have been living as expatriates in England, where his money and self-respect have dwindled away. As Edith says about her husband, "For years, Edward charmed the room with his extravagant speech and manner. Everyone loved him. Then it was as if the Depression had thrown a switch, and everyone wanted something quite different. He became stunningly unfashionable in a world run by those who had plodded along a narrower path." Edward's plan for salvaging what's left of his fortune calls for relocating his family to a remote estate he's inherited on Maryland's eastern shore. When the family arrives, they find a spooky handyman special, a candlelit, unheated mansion filled with hulking furniture, ripped Chinese wallpaper, and cast-off snakeskins among the shattered crystal. They also become acquainted with the tortuous etiquette governing relationships between the races, since Mason's Retreat is tended by black help. It's the Mason's secretive older son, 14-year-old Sebastian, who flourishes in the weird atmosphere of this Chesapeake Bay gory mansion. When Edward returns to England to oversee a failing factory he owns that rumors of war have resuscitated, Sebastian gleefully takes his father's place. Throughout the following year, Sebastian learns to love the land, Edith falls for a gentleman sailor, and young Simon pines for his father. Then Edward, who Tillman parallels to Neville Chamberlain rushing to Germany in 1939 to make a last-ditch effort at appeasement, abruptly returns to Mason's Retreat to reclaim his family and take them back to England. For Sebastian, however, peaceable surrender to his father's wishes is out of the question. I don't have time to rhapsodize over the multitude of descriptive passages in this novel that have lodged in my mind. Peaks of tidal ice in winter, striated with seaweed. The Masons sitting down to dinner as the dining room ceiling sags above their unprotected heads. Nor is there time to do justice to Tillman's delicate psychological portraits of Edith and Sebastian. Just be assured that, like James's classic novella, Mason's Retreat will be haunting readers for years to come.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Christopher Tillman's first novel, Mason's Retreat. We close today's show by remembering one of the passengers on the Value Jet that crashed in Florida on Saturday, Walter Hyatt. He was a guitarist, singer, and songwriter whose music was a blend of Western swing, folk, pop, jazz, and country. It can be heard on his two albums, King Tears and Music Town. In the early 80s, Hyatt was a member of Uncle Walt's band, a cult favorite in their home base of Austin, Texas. One of their biggest fans was a Texas musician who was just starting out then, named Lyle Lovett. He opened for Uncle Walt's band at many of their shows and returned the favor years later by having Hyatt open when Lyle Lovett and his large band toured. Last Saturday, Hyatt had just finished a gig in Key West, Florida, and was on his way to his daughter's college graduation when the plane went down. He was 46. Here's a song from his 1993 album, Music Town, on Sugar Hill Records. This is Out Where the Blue Begins.
Big city romance sounds like a big joke today. Walking down black streets under skies of gray. If I stay on, I'll be a burden to my friends. I'm going out where the blue begins. I bit on the red, it was the color of her lips. Rolled in the black, she picked up the chips. But if I stay on, nobody wins. I'm going out where the follow some old wagon track, try forgetting my way back, where the blue ambition. She cut a highway through my heart. If I take that highway, Burton's got a big head start. But if I stay on, nobody wins. I'm going out where the blue begins. I'm just going out where the blue.
Out Where the Blue Begins, sung and co-written by Walter Hyatt, who died on the jet that crashed in Florida. He was 46. He survived by his wife and three children. The youngest is 8 months old. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf, Joan Tui Westman, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Tariq Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the only comprehensive edition, introduction by Justin Kaplan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Red China Blues. Jan Wong tells us why she went to China as an idealistic radical student in the 70s. At first, she went along with the Cultural Revolution. Later, she became totally disillusioned. Years later, she returned to China as a reporter for the Toronto Globe and Mail. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.